Matt Segundo here. I'm sorry to have evaded my duties. You see, I was momentarily seduced by the allure of a certain religious organization who assured me that if I spent 11 years working on something, that there would be a light at the end of the tunnel, and maybe a New York Times Sunday Magazine profile, that I would get a new lease on life and make something of myself. But they also asked me to give up drinking. It is said that a fish cannot survive without water. And while my gills remain quite flexible to new ideas and new forms of breathing, this was simply too much to ask of anyone. So forget this organization. At least Charles Bach emerged with a novel in the end after so much time. Me? I've spent 11 years holed up in a motel room, and all I have to show for it is a stack of tequila bottles, a fear of dairy products, and angry and bitter tears. I suppose I should be grateful for this much and to be alive. But being alive still means paying taxes.
Okay, so I am here with Charles Bach, the author of the debut novel Beautiful Children. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Okay, so my first question is, I know you're from Vegas,
yeah.
And this novel is obviously about Vegas. So I guess the first question I have is, why Vegas and why now?
Those are very interesting questions. I guess now, because now is when I finished it, and when the good people at Random House chose to put it out. Vegas is a different story. I grew up there, and for a fair amount of my early writing life, I did not want to write about Las Vegas. I stayed away from it. I wanted to be a fiction writer who was not writing veiled autobiography. At a certain point, I think in my mid-20s, I started with a very short story about... that moved from different characters through Las Vegas during one night. And it was the short story couldn't contain it. I had too much. I was overloading every sentence with details and facts and ideas. And so it became something longer because there was some energy or something was happening in terms of what I was writing about that made it compelling, and it just kept it. Then it started to be a longer short story, then a novella, and it just was never any good, not for a million zillion reasons, but something was there. Probably every writer has to, especially early, has to write about things that compel them and matter to them more than anything else. It's such a long, hard trip that if you're not doing it about something that takes over your dreams, something's probably wrong.
Now, when you were writing this story, were you still living in Las Vegas, or had you left it essentially for good?
No, I stopped living there essentially when I was 18 years old. My family is still there. My parents are still there. And so I do go back a few times a year, but as far as a resident, I haven't been a Las Vegas resident now for 20 years now. And yet, yeah, that seems like a good place to break for the next question.
Well, I guess the reason I ask is that, do you find that it's easier to write about a place when you have a great degree of distance or when you're really close to it? Like, for example, did it ever occur to you to set your first novel in New York, seeing that you live here?
You know, I wrote some short stories that are in New York, and I honestly, in retrospect, I was probably learning about New York while I was writing them, and that maybe shows. And I'd be curious to think if we went back, we could probably look at pieces of writing where you can see someone learning about the work as they're doing it, and someone learning about the location. In my case, one thing that was very interesting is Las Vegas boomed and kept booming so that from the time I left at 18 to the time when I finished, which is when I was turning 37, it probably reinvented itself a number of times.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it the fastest growing city in America right now?
It has been the fastest growing city in America for over a decade. It stopped being the fastest growing city in America when suburbs then became the fastest growing cities in America, and the two two suburbs now fight back and forth for the title. It is just metastasized, you know, and become exponentially larger. And one thing that I had to learn to do was to pick a Vegas of my head that was a combination of what I knew and grew up in and what was happening to the city. And it couldn't be up to the moment Vegas, because the moment is constantly evolving. And you can never be as fast, especially in fiction. You can never be ahead of the curve. You have to be truer. You find an essential truth. And eventually I settled on a certain kind of Las Vegas that I think encapsulates what I believe is happening there and that allows me to move characters through. But there's way, you know, it's already, things that I have in the book have already become outdated if you were looking for the most current movement.
No, that's a very good point, because one thing that struck me about reading Beautiful Children is that it almost seems to be not quite out of time, but just that some parts of it feel very current and some parts of it feel like it's almost a hybrid of 80s, 90s. And I guess it's just in terms of what details you've put in and the time difference from when Newell disappeared to where we're at. So it almost felt like we're not quite in a vacuum, but we're not quite in a sort of linear time fashion. And we'll get into the, you know, plotting and linear and the storytelling later, but just the out of time feel, I guess.
Well, it's interesting. If you look in that, there's a certain point where the girl with the shaved head talks about starving children in Ethiopia. And that's a sign of how long it took me to write the book, because now they'd be starving in Darfur. Now it would be a different reference point. But that, you know, and it wasn't until the galleys or something that I saw that and I thought, that's dated. Yeah.
So at this point, yeah, let's talk a bit about the structure of the book, because it's multiple viewpoints. There are many characters involved.
Yeah.
How did this sort of come about?
Oh, it came about through trial and failure. I think anyone my age or anyone who became came of age during the late 90s or mid 90s as a writer or was a student during that time had an amazing amount of, the influences were amazing, because you got Dennis Johnson and Jesus' Son comes out, Infinite Jest pops out, Strong Motion, Purple America, and more importantly for me, Ring of Brightest Angels Around Heaven. And then Mary Gateskill stories and A.M. Holmes and all these writers who are just breaking down barriers left, right, and George Saunders, Civil War Land, Bad Decline. Like, the list is pretty large. And they kind of, one thing that I really wanted was that I loved and responded to were certain things in Infinite Jest, Purple America, the title story of Brightest Ring, and even Strong Motion, of layers and things happening simultaneously. Pulp Fiction also comes out during that time, which is just, you know, a reference point for anyone who cares about non-linear or interesting or different structures. And also you've got Volman bopping here and there, and you know, what the hell's going on there? And so I had these influences and the idea of something where I wanted it layered. And it was really a horrible mistake. because I had 3 years in, look at it, huge mess, no idea what's going on. And the choices were basically give up and start something new or figure it out. 6 years in, second draft gets done or third draft gets done. No idea what's going on. Huge mess, but a closer mess. And I think I had an idea and I stayed with it. And as I wrote, I grew as a writer, and each draft allowed for corrections to the previous draft. And I learned to find spaces where things were possible, and also spaces where I had to get back to the narrative, and learned, you know, that you have to have a through line where people could follow, and you had to have peaks and valleys where you reach a certain Dostoevsky and end of a chapter, high moment of drama, and that gives a breath to go away and do something else. And
so clearly you had very ambitious works and authors in mind as you were writing this.
Insanely. Yes.
Which sort of brings the question of how much did you have to write in order to produce the 400 odd pages that are in this book?
I don't know the answer to that question. It is a good question. The truth is, I worked on this novel for 10 years, and they weren't 10 years of watching Seinfeld at 11 p.m. They were 10 years of where the high priority of my life. When I was dating the woman who's now my wife, there was a point where I would only go out with her two nights a week because I just couldn't give more time to that. And she didn't like it, but now she's in graduate school and she understands a little more.
Clearly she understood enough that she married you anyway.
Yes, yes, it is good. And a huge amount of faith on her part because she married me when I was in the middle of, you know, it wasn't done in fact, I was like going back for the last year of rewrites and we had nothing, but so it's a testament to her. But I wrote ungodly amounts. Friends used to joke about how big this book was going to be and how many pages, because there were drafts, there were 900 page drafts, there were drafts, there were 700 pages drafts. People didn't want, you know, I wouldn't show it to people because I knew you can't do it to them. It's too big of a commitment and it means too much. And I can't give it to them until it's the best I could do. And in my case, I had to do a lot of writing to find out what the story was. I had to do tons of cutting, then more rewriting, and then more cutting. And it did not, you know, my hope is that at the end it reads like it always existed in that form, and that there's this tremendous logic and brain to it that's very organic and feels like it grew, very much like the glyph on the cover, that it goes in all directions and comes back and is and just somehow works. The truth is, every book has an internal logic, but you don't start out with it. You have to find it. I think every writer has to work into finding it and listen for it. And in my case, it involved more failure than I can ever explain to you in a brief interview.
Well, I guess with that in mind, and to also bring back what I was talking about with regards to distance, is that another thing that struck me is that all the characters seem to have particular goals that they can never quite reach. And it's, you know, with Lorraine and Lincoln not only trying to find out what happened to Newell, but trying to find their way back to each other, if at all. Sherry making the movie in her head with the screenplay representations. Ponyboy trying to, I don't know, eke out some romanticism out of his life.
Right.
Kenny and Bing Beiderbecke. So I guess, you know, as you said before, a lot of this was discovered early on in drafts, but, you know, did this theme sort of jump out at you? Or
I think it's interesting you bring that up. It's quite possible that those are all psychological reflections of me as I'm working on the book and this thing that will never be finished and never be published and never nothing. And so every character gets this impossible dream. I don't know that I was so consciously aware of it. I do know that you have to, fiction is about journeys in one way or another, that whoever it is, Odysseus has to go home. Maybe it's not Odysseus. Maybe it's someone else, Brad Pitt, whoever Brad Pitt plays, has to, you know, go home, has to get inside the Sparta. I don't know, I'm mixing references, but that fiction's about journeys. And so, especially novels are about journeys. And so everyone got a journey in some form or another. And beyond that, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how conscious it was.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, something that is more conscious, obviously, is, and it runs through the book, is the theme of missing children, be it those who disappear and those who run away.
Right.
And one thing that really struck me almost as soon as I heard that this book existed and it was being set in Vegas is it really got me thinking again about Carrie Saez's disappearance. The 6-year-old boy who had disappeared from a Vegas school in the late 70s.
Yeah, I went to that religious school.
You did?
I went to Temple Beth Shalom Hebrew School, afternoon Hebrew school, and it was at the day school where he disappeared. Yeah, yeah, that was a part of my childhood. That was, I mean, I wasn't involved with it or anything, and I didn't.
Well, you would have been, like, close to his age at the time.
I was a little older than him, yeah, yeah. Wow, you're sharp. You are sharp, Sarah. How did you know about this?
I have a master's degree in forensic science.
Wow. Wow.
So that and Eitan Potts are the two cases that really struck me.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, oddly, I think actually when I was growing up, too, because in Carrie's case, he was Jewish, he went to a day school. It was just so, how could he get abducted off of a school grounds? And in Eitan's case, you know, he lived in New York, which is where I wanted to live, and again, abducted in broad daylight, both Jewish kids.
Both Jewish kids, and just bizarre. Yeah. Yeah. I would guess, in fact, there is a reference to Carrie in
it's
the book.
It's very oblique. But I did catch it.
Yeah, you know, good for you. Yeah. There's a number of references to all kinds of things throughout the book that are equally oblique. All the names of runaways in chapter 7 are either mashups of kids who did run away, or they are actually names of people who did run away and were missing in Nevada. Although I then took liberties with their stories and fictionalized them and did different things. The story, there's a number of things in there that are tributes or that are signifiers, you know, that aren't affecting the story but inform things. I don't know that Carrie was someone that I thought consciously about. His story certainly was in my head during this, and it's something I grew up with, and that brown Rolls Royce, you know, I always heard of it. And when I was a kid growing up in Las Vegas, you literally looked on the streets for a brown Rolls Royce, because it was, or if you saw one, like, geez, I wonder if that's the car. I had, you know, but there's untold amounts of stories that went into this book for that part of it.
Was there any particular case that really affected you that you felt you had to at least reference in some way? Or was it just a question of amalgamating
I didn't want to appropriate anyone's story for the book. And that was very important to me. So there was none where I put it hook, line, and sinker. But in the course of writing this, which was a very long time, you know, I spent a lot of time where I would see someone and sit, give them money and talk to them, see someone, buy them supplies, talk to them, never take notes, but then go home and write down my impressions. After I sold the book, I did a couple of months of writing workshops at Covenant House. I didn't do them while I was working on the book because I didn't, again, want to take anyone's stories. I think there, it's all, I had an idea in my head of someone who's so unhappy in their skin and they can't escape them that they have to escape their surroundings. Then I learned all these stories and I modified them towards what I wanted to do. I was just in New Orleans, and there's a troop of homeless kids, and some of them, they all play instruments, of violins, accordions, and whatever. And different members teach new members the songs so that then they can do street performances. That, to me, is an amazing, wonderful, life-affirming, great thing. I don't know that that would have been... I would have had to twist that for my book and somehow make it not as life-affirming.
No, of course.
You know? But I had something in my head, and then I had to match it. And eventually I learned enough and gathered enough information where I could create lives that I felt were very, very compelling and could do the things that I wanted to do. I mean, a real hope for the novel is that it's about people with your and my educational background might cross the street to avoid, and that it can foster some sense of compassion and understanding for those that are basically lost and forgotten and damned, and who do it to themselves, but life does it to all of us. And to take someone on a journey where you're gonna care about everyone in the book. Lincoln, Lorraine, Newell, the family unit that really starts it off. But that as we drag along, you're going to care about a stripper with prosthetic breasts who lights herself on fire. A guy who's really a sleazebag, who's going to try and get his girlfriend into porn. A 17-year-old who, you know, who's so confused about his sexuality that he might do something completely unthinkable. And that every one of them is going, hopefully by the end, that you will affect you and stay with any reader. And that was a huge, aside from the technical goals, that was a huge, hugely ambitious and probably insane goal, you know, something I wanted to do, and that, you know, kind of possessed me as a something that I needed to do if this book was going to work at all.
And just to go back to what you were talking about, how you didn't want to make this book life-affirming, and clearly there's a lot of bleakness and despair going on, and longing and, you know, unreachable goals, as I referred to before. And yet, there's still, every so often, this sliver of hope that everybody can keep going.
Well, we have to. And there needs to be, I mean, the runaway stories are not life-affirming because I didn't want to encourage a 16-year-old reading this book to take off. That was really important to me. Now, maybe that 16-year-old will need to do other things to secure his own life. But I don't know that life on the street is a romantic thing, and I didn't want that. I did want hope in the book, and I do hope that there's rays and slivers, and the best of humanity should also be in there, and people should be trying and doing the best they can, even if it's an effort that is misguided, that there should be tons upon tons of hope through it, although hopefully by the end there's certain prescriptions to that we should all try and do better in our lives, and that was important to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's even a line I'm going to paraphrase, but that Kenny utters pretty early in the book, like, shit happens and then more shit happens, and that's the future.
Yeah.
It's like there's so many ways to interpret it. One would be the really bleak one of, like, well, shit's going to happen, so why should I do anything? Or, well, if shit's going to happen, I might as well make the best of it and actually make something of myself. And Kenny's really on the precipice of that.
Yeah. Well, Kenny, you know, right. Good point. And that's a good line to quote. In Kenny's case, he just has no chance, and he's overwhelmed, and is this kid who loves to draw and is drawing, you know, using, you know, his dad's porn magazines as his art models, and has no clue about how to move through the world or do anything. And I very much remember being a teenager and having all these ambitions and hopes or ideas. I would have loved to do stand-up comedy, but how the hell do you do that? How do you even go to a... I don't know how you even get involved with something like that, or the steps you're supposed to take or anything. And the, you know, like, the world can be so big and so, like, the procedures involved with it just absolutely beyond. And yet, what do you do? Do you just stop? I mean, because life is going to move forward. Time is going to move forward to all of us.
For some people, they would.
Yeah, right, right. And that was a thought I always had when I was writing the book, is that the day is going to pass. Either I'm going to do work on the book and move forward with my problems, or they're going to be exactly the same. And I just couldn't, for me, I couldn't, it was very hard, I couldn't live with myself if it was the latter, the second one and not the first one.
So it's like, even if this book was a perceived albatross, you weren't going to just chuck it and try something else.
What could I do? I couldn't, after 6 years, I couldn't just, maybe I should have started over, but I couldn't. I couldn't just put it in a drawer and be, I lived in fear of being one of those people with a half-finished book in a drawer and a day job and trying to, and never working on it and never knowing, you know. And, and honestly, at a certain point, I didn't have any professional life to speak of. I had all these crappy jobs. I had a third shift legal proofreader. I did some ghostwriting, which for a while helped me out. The last year of the book, I was working 2 days a week, 10 hours a day, at a celebrity tabloid, like making sausages, you know, processing the crap that they do, that they, information they get into their little 400 word nuggets. Horrible. Like, that was my future. I'd written myself into this corner, and there was only one way out, and that was, you know, I'd put my eggs in this basket. And meanwhile, writing, while as hard as it can be, as you know, can be ecstatically fun and can be amazingly entertaining. And I entertain myself tremendously with this book. I think the book, you know, it's very dark, but it's also, to me, it's fun. It's fun as hell, you know. It quotes kung fu movies. It quotes, you know, Iron Maiden and suicidal tendencies and all, you know, and people have, there's a lot of good jokes and a lot of really interesting and intellectually interesting questions in there. And so that was I could live with that. I could live with working on something that engaged me much more than going to a bunch of book parties and going, oh, poor me, poor me, poor me. I'd rather, you know, whatever feelings I had about books that were being published, whatever admiration I had for a lot of wonderful work that was being published, I also did have this feeling, I am building a bomb in my basement. I'm going to blow up the world. Yeah, and either the bomb was going to blow me up or I was going to blow up the world. But that, you know, like Axl Rose says, victory or death, man. Victory or death.
It's interesting you bring up Axl in light of Chinese democracy.
I've seen the new Axl Rose band 5 times. I have T-shirts that say Chinese democracy starts now from the 2003 tour. I have a T-shirt from the 1999 Vegas show when it was Chinese democracy was supposed to start then. And now like 3 of the band members of the new Guns N' Roses are now out of the band. Like, it is interesting because it was, you know, this was Chinese democracy, you know, this was my thing. Only I hadn't done Appetite for Destruction first. I like to believe that I ended up with Appetite for Destruction, you know, like Literature for Destruction or something. I don't know. But yeah, it was that kind of quest. Only unfortunately, in Axel's case, I think he sits on his couch for long stretches of time or has legal issues.
Or gets cheek implants.
You know, or whatever. You know, having said that, let me also say that some of the shows I saw with that new band were fucking incredible. And they're not the old band, and they're not any as good as that, but nothing is as good as that. There won't be anything in my lifetime as good as that. So what can you do?
So just taking this a bit of a step further,
go.
You know, you live with this book for 10 years, and now it's published. It's in book format.
Yeah.
So was it weird that it's finally done and you don't have it in your basement, essentially?
It is bizarre beyond words. It's very hard. After so much time, I did not understand how people could live how people live their lives without writing books. You know, like, how do you do things? And now I've had to get used to that. And with the promotional stuff for the book, I haven't had as much time to write as I would like. And it's now it's starting to get to me. It actually is, because I do have another project that I want to get off the ground, and I'm trying to get off the ground, and I don't want it to take 10 years. And at the same time, I do feel distant from that everyday involvement with a text, which is a very, very special kind of delicious torture, you know? So yeah, it is.
But you just answered my next question, which was that whether you had a project in the works. Because I think what often befalls a lot of debut novelists, they get so caught up with, oh, my first book is being published, there's all this stuff to do, that they just don't write. And then you're right, say 10 years or so pass.
Well, I have an idea for a project, and I've taken a lot of notes, and I put the notes in the computer. But the truth is that I may have that problem. Right now, it's been a little while since I've done work on it. Promoting a book takes a lot of effort. Building a website for your book takes a ton of effort. The things that I did and that I was involved with my website, which include getting a bunch of unsigned indie bands to contribute music for it, that is no small task. And I feel like I've been doing lots of work, which has been wonderful, fun work to do, but I haven't been sitting on the couch just, you know, checking out. I don't know what's going on Lost. I've never watched American Idol. I follow the Mets and watch some sports, but I've been working pretty hard, but I have not been working hard. And I've done, and this summer I did a lot of writing, but it's a good question, you know, and especially because we all know second books get a lot of scrutiny. Second books usually are disappointments, and I'm sure every single writer who has a first book that gets some attention or thinks to themselves that not me, and you know, who knows? You know, I may who knows? You know, it's a good question.
Although, I mean, in theory, you mentioned that you'd done some ghostwritten work, so it's your first book, but it's really not.
Right, and I wrote it 8,000 times. So really, I have a whole oeuvre of books in that novel, yeah.
So, a couple more questions. One is, I want to hear more about this CD that you put together and how that came about.
Oh, well, there's a CD for... The CD is a promotional CD that's sent out to book blogs and a few other people, and music blogs and things like that. But my website, www.beautifulchildren.net, is a hell of a site. The designer, John Citarella, is kind of a genius. I mean, not kind of, he is a genius. And it's an amazing website. And originally we wanted music for every page. And I just had a lot of favorite songs in the beta version, which were just... You know, at Guns N' Roses, Nine Inch Nails. I had some songs from bands that I really loved that are unsigned, like the Rock and Roll Soldiers and MC Chris, who is an amazing rapper. And I had a string version of Wish You Were Here, the Pink Floyd song by Rasputina. And I was just really, you know, and there were 7 songs, and I was just thrilled with them. And then a friend of mine who actually manages a band, was like, wow, this site is astonishing. How did you get permission for all these songs? you know. And so then, which is great in retrospect, because it made me go out, think a little harder and come up with a little better. I have a friend of mine, his name Wendy Case, who is the lead singer for a band called The Paybacks, out of Detroit, which has opened for the White Stripes and Joan Jett and been on tour with a lot of super indie bands and hard rock bands and garage bands early, mid 2003 to 2005. And I'm a big fan of theirs, and I called her, I emailed her and said, look, this is what's going on. Can you give me a song? with her and her manager, we ended up with a bunch of bands, a lot of them from the Detroit area.
Oh, nice.
Who a lot of them gave songs and were happy to contribute songs to the website. There's a band called the Rock and Roll Soldiers who are actually from Oregon, who I saw them as an opening act for someone, and the lead singer almost got in a fight with this audience who was completely hostile to them. But it's an amazing set, and I came away like, who the hell are these guys? And a singer-songwriter from Kentucky named Jamie Barnes, who I saw at the Happy Ending Reading Series, and he was sang a beautiful song and had an amazing voice. And so I would just contact people and say, hey, this is what I'm doing. Do you have a song that maybe you could, these are the sites, these are the different pages. Is there anything you can do? And, you know, there's so many talented people out there. There's so much great music that it's been totally worthwhile. Because Trent Reznor doesn't need any more exposure. Or Radiohead. You know, there was a band on there, Dave Navarro's band, The Panic Channel, on the original version of the site. They could have actually used the exposure. They had a beautiful song called Outsider that we designed a page to. But, you know, Capitol Records, who owns the masters to it, and who even dropped the band, like, they're not even going to respond to my request to use the song.
No.
So here's an example where, you know, where major labels are the problem. That, you know, those they are the problem. There's tons and tons of unbelievable bands out there. I don't know how to find them. You don't know how to find them. But
MySpace only goes so far.
Are you going to search through 18 million MySpace pages? No one knows. This was a case where I lucked out, and because I knew a few people, I was able to hopefully give some real exposure to these bands. And then we started a MySpace project where hopefully any band or anyone who wants to read the book, write a song about anything they want, send it into the MySpace page or contact the MySpace page, we'll put it up. And, I would love it if Slash did a song. I would love it if Buckethead did a song for the thing. I'd love it if, you know, Trent Reznor wanted to compose a masterpiece or Jane's Addiction wanted to get back together, which they should do, to do a song for the soundtrack. But I'll also fucking love it if some crazy bastard in the middle of Omaha, Nebraska just tears shit up and sends something in, or anyone, because the truth is there's so many talented people in this world that we don't know about. There's so many people building bombs in their basement. I'm always, always, always going to be a person in favor, you know, and rooting for them. That doesn't mean that every bomb is successful, and it doesn't mean that every unknown writer is ready to have a book published, because if I would have taken 9.5 years instead of 10, no publisher would have taken it. It took as long as it takes. But what it does mean is that, you know, throw those fucking bombs. You know, the world, we don't need any more. We don't need too many more novels about the Upper West Side and a lonely girl looking for love, you know, among the China patterns. Fuck, you know. We, you know, but then again, someone may write, you know, George Eliot may be out there writing that novel, and someone's writing that novel, and maybe I'll want to take a bullet for it because it'll be so wonderful. So I should just shut my mouth about that.
I'd almost ended on that, but there is one last question, okay. And that is, Beautiful Children talks a lot about comic books, and unless I'm mistaken, you wrote an essay about 5 years ago.
You're right. No, you're not mistaken.
So, I guess, how do you compare your take on comics then and now, especially because we're in a serious comics and graphic novel boom?
Well, it's interesting because I find myself very defensive for the novel in this comic and graphic novel boom.
How so?
One, it comes with the understanding that I am not I have not read Chris Ware's work, which I understand is excellent. I have not read Alison Bechtel's work, which I understand is excellent. I did read Mouse, which, you know, was wonderful. I read an interview with Juno Diaz where he talked about how comic books didn't get the respect they deserve, and writers are appropriating from comics, and we need the comic book writer who gets his own Pulitzer. And I was under the impression that Art Spiegelman actually had won some awards.
That's right.
You know, I think that right. I am sure that comic books and graphic novels are very worthwhile. I think Hate, Peter Baggy from the early 90s was, you know, if not a genius, something close and very important and doesn't get any of the accolades he deserves. That having been said, I also know far too many educated, smart people my age who do not read or who read less than a handful of books a year. Right now, I could not be more sure that there are way more superb writers out there than superb comic books. That's my own feeling, and it's because my adult life has been devoted to reading and writing. And it's easier to read a graphic novel. It's cooler. It takes much less time. But, you know, you can't fuck with Mary Gateskill's Veronica as a reading experience. You can't screw with Edward P. Jones, you know, and the known world.
I know.
I wish there was a way that comic books could do well without it being at the expense of literary fiction, which is, there is no shortage of great writers in this country, but readers who care in this country that is dying in America. That is fucking dying. And that concerns me to no end. And so my take is a little different because I find myself concerned with having readers and people out there because I just don't understand how. I do think that things will always survive between the cracks, and there will always be a significant portion underground happening of people who care, and that will always be part of America. But it's going to be further and further away from the rest of America. And if that's the case, we have no shot. We have no fucking shot at all, just as a country and as a people. And
so with that in mind, how would you, say, get the teens of your book and their generation to get, you know, either back into reading or into reading?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer. I know the answer for me was to try and create an experience, to create a book that just, you have to hope, you know, some people say it's too violent and some people say it's too graphically sexual and this and that. But I can't tell you how many, I was just signing books the other day for the publishing house and all the fucking interns, you know, wanted autographed copies. Hopefully that can do something. Hopefully just writing a book that people will want to read. Now, whether they can hear about it, that's why I spent all summer with a genius designer trying to build a website. And that's why we're trying to do things with music and trying to reach beyond. Literary blogs are great and book reviews are great, but you know, I am honestly trying to do things beyond that. You know, House of Leaves somehow did, and it has a life, and that's interesting to me. That's, you know, that younger people are more into that book than maybe a generation of experimental novels who might have novelists who inspired it. That's interesting to me. I don't know what the answers are. I know, like, McSweeney's appeals to a certain type of kid and a certain type of reader, and that's great. that I don't know that that's my reader. You know, I do think to myself, like, there's all these smart people out there who love Marilyn Manson, and they're disaffected and they're disassociated and they know how to read, or they love, you know, whatever, Marilyn Manson's 10 years ago, but as in the middle 90s. How do you get a book to that pierced goth kid in fucked up clothes? And at the same time, can you make a, you know, can you make it be just as good of a book for a serious reader in their mid-40s or mid-50s, because there'll be different parts that people will respond to? That was my solution for this book. For the next book, it might be a tender, touching little love song with, you know, with elephants and painted toenails. I don't fucking know. But this time, this is what I, you know, I do think that it's horrible, but I think every single author is going to have to figure out this question, because otherwise you risk the danger of writing books that no one ever hears about, except that no one ever hears about. And that doesn't reduce the value of that single book, but we all want to be read, you know? Yeah.
And even though that's a slightly bleak note, I'm going to call it now. Oh. And thanks so much.
This you was were great.
A really
Thank
great
you,
interview.
Sarah. I had a great time.